Welcome to Dig, a history podcast.
No, we have to introduce,
gonna lead us
introduce
in.
The episode.
Oh, do it.
Well,
then.
Yes. Okay. So quiet in the room. Okay. Welcome to this special episode to kick off our series in which we will release our 100th episode as Dig. Aye.
Woohoo!
Woo! We're really excited to be joining you more or less live. I mean, people who are going to be listening to this Sunday and thereafter will not be live, but we have some people who are in this room with us in this weird Zoom quarantine room who are like listening to this live action conversation. So our goal for today is to just sort of celebrate this special anniversary. We've been recording together now for 3 years. Actually, today I think is our actual 3-year anniversary since we switched up when we rebranded to be Dig.
Today is specifically
today, May 1st.
That's really cool.
Oh, how did that work out? Yeah, that's amazing.
I know.
Because I plan all things ahead of time.
three years. That is insane.
100 episodes is insane.
100 episodes. Yeah.
So I'm very tired just thinking about it.
I know, right?
So thanks to those of you, Colin, Elizabeth, and Leah, for joining us today in this live recording. And we're just going to talk about, we're going to answer questions that listeners have submitted ahead of time. So Sarah, kick us off.
Can I ask my own question first? Is this the first time we've ever had folks join us, like, in the room to listen?
To listen, yes.
Yeah. I don't think we've ever had, like... guests before, a live audience before. Yeah.
No,
I'm very nervous.
This is the first.
Don't F up.
Okay.
No cursing.
Brought to you by the COVID-19
really no cursing?
Pandemic.
Because that's the only thing I say is
swear. That's true. What, April, are you all right?
Sorry, my dog just came racing down the stairs like a fucking bat out of hell.
So actually, that is like very on brand that we have at some point
a dog.
Your dog, specifically your dog.
Yes.
True.
In an episode somewhere. All right, are we ready for our first real question? This is a very difficult question. How did you all meet? Who wants to go first?
Well, Sarah, you were the first at the university, so you should probably lead us off.
Oh, the first at UB, you mean?
Yeah. You were there before any of us.
I've been at UB for like my entire life and I'm never leaving. Hopefully, anyway.
I don't know. I started in 2011. Is that when you started the master's program? Yeah.
No. I started the master's program in 2007.
Yeah. Because I started the PhD in 2010, man.
Yeah. Mm. So.
Okay. No. Okay. I would have been 2009. I started my master's. Never mind. You were first.
Because I'm very old. So I met Averill at some point during our PhD orientation. Mm-hmm. But I was very standoffish. I will put the blame on me for a long time. I don't think I make friends particularly quickly, or I used to. I was very standoffish. I was one of, I think I was at the time the only graduate student in our department who had kid at the time, which seems like a dream. I wish I only had kid right now. I have multiple kids. but so we didn't really hang out. We ran the GHA, or you ran the GHA, and I just showed up to stuff for a while.
2011. That was the year that Marissa started.
And then we sort of became friends. Once we got into the dissertation phase, and we had to sort of lean on each other more for, you know, that kind of writing support. And we started our writing group and everything. Marissa, I met.
Wait. Let me do my.
Go ahead.
I met Marissa first.
Yes, I didn't meet you. I didn't meet you for a while.
No, Marissa, the summer before she was going to start the PhD program, which was 2 years after Sarah and I started, she sent me this email.
Oh, no.
Asking if we could.
Oh, my God. Are you pulling the email up or something?
No, I don't have that email anymore. She sent me an email asking if we could meet because she was really nervous about the program and she just wanted to, like, get a feel for what to expect. So we met at Barnes & Noble and she talked for 1,000 years. On brand, as they say. And I knew from that moment that here we had something special, a budding friendship with me being a rock.
Shut up, and except I had a baby with me and everyone was like, ew, what is that thing?
I did think that, but I didn't say it out loud.
True, yeah. Yeah, so I met April first and then I met Sarah kind of through hanging out with April.
Yeah, I was going to say we met at one of the GHA meetings. GHA picnic. You asked me some question. I had Emma there and you asked me some really weird, like breastfeeding question or something. And I was like, oh, you were like, oh, isn't she walking by now or something? And I was like, what? I remember being like, this bitch.
Oh, I remember. I was like, is she sitting up yet? And you were like, no.
She was, I don't know, 4 months old or something. I was like, what are you, crazy?
Mm. I wasn't trying to be one of those people.
But I didn't know Marissa then. And now if Marissa asked me that, I'd be like, it's just Marissa.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then we became friends pretty quickly because we had the kid thing in common.
And then in the background of all of this, because Elizabeth, you must have started the year after.
I started the master's program in 2012, right, I think. Yeah,
so the same year that Marissa started the PhD. But you were like this tall, beautiful, glamorous, like quiet, but also powerful.
Mm-hmm. She'd walk into the grad lounge and I'd be like, oh my God, she's so horrifying.
Goddess who just like walked in and out of the grad lounge while we're all sitting in there like eating our snacks and gossiping and crying. Yeah. And
she had like those, you know, bangs. Oh,
the Betty Page bangs.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Y'all are making me feel like
embarrassed or no. It was great. We were like,
damn, I used to did be hot and now
Well, and I talked to you
downhill.
Do you remember me talking to you in the hallway? Like I don't mind talking to anybody. So I was just like, hey, what's up? What's your name? And you said something like, well, I have kids or something. And I was like, oh, I do too. And you're like, oh, okay. And then we talked for a bit. I don't know if you remember that. I was sitting right outside.
I don't remember that. I remember meeting you in our Colonial Latin American seminar.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, we all met.
Oh, at grad school.
Long story short.
To summarize that long and boring and winding story is that we all met at the grad program at UB, at University of Buffalo, while we worked on our PhDs.
Yeah. But I think...
And we formed some sort of like mommy cult or something.
No. Yeah.
I mean...
We've been known as the mommy cult.
No, we weren't really because April hates kids.
I hate children.
Plus one.
Yeah. I don't know.
Please. You're all my cult. That's what the important thing is.
Yeah.
But we worship at the altar of
age. It's interesting, though, how, you know, you look at that. I look at that time and it doesn't, like, going through it, it didn't seem like a very long time, you know, as you're kind of experiencing it. And now looking back, I'm like, oh, my gosh. Like, Avril, you and I started graduate school together 10 years ago. Or almost 10 years ago, right? And so it's interesting to think that, like, there were times where the four of us were not friends. Or we were maybe acquaintances. Like, we saw each other at, like, you know, Plesser, the Plesser Graduate Conference.
I don't think it was until the podcast that we all became
No, I don't think so either. Like, we knew each other. I mean, we knew each other, and some of us were closer than others. But, like, Elizabeth especially, like... I had never really had a conversation with you, I don't think, a real conversation until we started. Well,
and for me, and I know to an extent for some of y'all, like going through grad school, you know, I'm almost a decade older than most grad students. So it was just a whole different, you know, I just wasn't interested in hanging out necessarily, you know.
No, and
sitting on somebody's floor and drinking beer.
And that's why I say, like, at the beginning, I was probably standoffish. I think part of that was self-protection because I did have a kid and I was afraid of people, I don't know, judging that, especially Avril.
Please, you didn't know I hated children until long after they were actually friends.
Until she
No, I think it had more to do with you just seemed like such a powerhouse that I thought there was no way that I could ever kind of keep up. But, you know, my experience anyway was similar, Elizabeth. You know, you have kids and your life is very different.
You're kind of at a different life stage. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But I'll drag you along. You can keep up because I'm going to hold you by the hand and pull you.
It's true.
We're done.
She doesn't give you an option.
True.
All right. This question actually kind of goes along with that question. I tried to like put them in chronological order. How did you get started? So I'm interpreting that question to mean, how did we get started as a podcast? How did we get started as Dig specifically? Although we do have a little bit of a longer history than that, but yeah, how did we get started?
How do we get started? Well, in 2015, I put out a call on that damn grad listserv, and some people responded, and among them was this magnificent enigma unicorn called Elizabeth Garner Masaryk, and then my two buddies, Marissa and Sarah. Well, actually, Marissa and Sarah did not respond to the email.
No, they did not
respond.
I don't
And then
read
I was like, oh.
Listserv emails. Okay, yeah. I have too much.
Listen, I was like 900 months pregnant.
Quiet. We're gonna start a podcast. We're gonna record this. And Marissa and Sarah are like, we want to be part of that. Include us. And so then I did include them in the following emails. And then we started just like playing around with audio and what kind of things we liked to listen to as podcast listeners. And we started making episodes, and they were like bad for a year, and then they were kind of good for a year, and then we branched off and started Dig in 2017, and it has been really good because we were made for this life.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that was different going into Dig after our first project was that we kind of shut things down and instead we kind of took this we took the summer off right before we released our first episodes. Mm-hmm. And that gave us a ton of time to meet and really talk through what we wanted to be and what we wanted to do, so that when we did launch in the fall, we had like a very clear
we had like a business
plan. Yeah, exactly. You know? We had a clear sort of vision of what kind of podcast we were and what kind of history we wanted to do and how we were going to be organized, all things that we had not done the first time around.
So in giving advice to people who are thinking about starting some kind of project like this, start one, learn and make your mistakes, and then do the real thing. For
sure. Yeah, like a garbage practice one.
Right. Yeah. And that's why, for those of you who listen, you know, sort of, or have listened for a long time, sometimes you'll see us like re-release an episode. That's because a lot of times it's an episode that we really loved, but we did so long ago that we did it like before we were having transcriptions or having copy that we could post, or before we had microphones like we have now. So we were,
or before we had people who would actually do the work they were supposed to do to prepare to do the episode.
Well, that too. But, you know, so every once in a while we're like, oh, like recently Frankenstein, right? We were like, oh man, Frankenstein was such a great episode. And it made us sad to think that it was kind of out there, but nobody was listening to it because the audio was so bad and the organization was terrible. So like it's been kind of cool in recent days to take what we know now and take those old episodes and kind of revamp them and re-release them.
Yeah, I do remember recording Frankenstein the first time in Sarah's guest room closet, me, Sarah, and Marissa, in that.
And I even farted at one point,
too. Yes, it was terrible.
Which is like, really?
And if I recall, if I recall correctly, there was also two breastfeeding infants in that room with us. Because
who were just like lying.
Every once in a while, there'd be like a noise.
Yeah. Yep. Of a baby being like rooting around for a boob or something. And then we'd have to stop and everyone would be like, oh my God, kids are so disgusting. Yeah. And then we'd start again. Yep. Yeah.
We don't record like that anymore.
That's why we record with my dog in my house.
Right.
There's no children here.
Yeah.
Ave, keep making sure you're facing the microphone when you talk. I hear your voice going in and out.
Yeah, see? Yeah. You're the big boss lady.
See, you're not perfect either, you jerk.
Right.
All right.
Anything else about how we started that you guys want to reflect on? The first, like, the beginning?
No, I mean, our first project, History Buffs, was really, you know, I'm proud of that, despite the fact that we turned out some subpar stuff.
We were just babies.
And we did a really good job of, like, figuring out what the heck we were doing.
Right.
We had zero experience, zero training. We just dove in head first and figured it out along the way.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it was a really tough call to kind of end that project and start a new one. But I am really glad that we did. During that transitional period was a bit... There's some drama and it was just difficult to end that project and to start.
Yeah, like it would be any kind of, any kind of relationship.
Any venture.
Yeah.
We were breaking up the band.
Yeah, but I'm glad.
Going on a solo act with four people. That's not really solo.
Behind the music.
Except in Behind the Music, it's always like, and then the Beatles broke up and Paul McCartney started Wings. Like, it's not great.
Isn't it always like, oh, it's Yoko Ono's fault? That's like,
because it's always the woman's fault, right?
Thread of that. Yeah.
I can't remember what I was going to say. Oh, I think very fondly of the kind of very beginning of Dig, partly because we had that really fun day where we were like, we need to have a photo shoot. So we have promotional images. Oh, we all went to Elizabeth's house and like we were all dressed to the nines and like took a bunch of pictures. And
we should probably do that again.
We really should update that. But it was just, it was really exciting and it was really fun to start this project and to have so many ideas bouncing around. And what I think is really great is that was 3 years ago and we still have that energy. You know, we still have that commitment to the project. And sometimes we're like, oh, fuck my life, it's copy week. But at the same time, you know, I wouldn't trade that.
Mm-mm. I'm always glad when it's written and done.
We can be more enthusiastic after the copy is written. During copy week, less so.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I think I'm kind of different in that I, of course, often don't have time to do copy week. So I'm like freaking out, like, how am I going to make this happen? But I genuinely enjoy writing it for some reason. Like, even when I'm really stressed out. Obviously, you all enjoy looking into the topics you look into. But when you're really stressed out, sometimes it's not enjoyable because you can't relax and enjoy it. And for some reason, it's always been an escape to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, especially when I was trying to not write my dissertation, I'd be like, oh yeah, I'm gonna do mm-hmm. this episode about whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice to be able to get out of our little, I don't know, academic boxes sometimes.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
Nope, I don't agree.
Right. It's like, nope, it. I want to be
every
in my box.
Word is just like pried out of me with like cold, slimy hands.
Yeah, we have different approaches.
It's really difficult for me.
Yeah. I mean, it's just how we're different, you know? And Elizabeth's like really good at the businessy side and being like, I don't know, professional and having a filter and all of these adult things that I don't know how to do.
Word.
Yeah.
Next.
Okay. How did you guys juggle completing your PhDs and writing, recording and editing a podcast?
I mean, okay, so I just defended almost a month ago.
Yay!
Thank you. And so about exactly a year ago now, like, I was ready to quit. I was ready to quit it all. I was ready to walk away. Like, it was just a really low point. And I think that happens a lot of time in like people's third year or like that next to last year. It's like there's just this breakthrough you have to make. And once I pushed through that, it all just kind of came out. And honestly, for the last year, I have shut down. I had to get off social media. I had to get off everything. And because I knew I wasn't going to finish if I didn't. So for me, maybe it wasn't a balance at all. It was like for the past year, it's just been academia. So I don't know if I've been... the best person
right
to say,
it's more but, of like a sprint and then a walk instead of just a steady jog.
But you know, in a way, I mean, for all of us, you know, it is a marathon, and like some weeks are
copy. See how far we can push this analogy.
Yeah, but you know, some week is copy week, and it's like that's all you do for 3 or 4 days. You're just writing straight your copy because the deadline is Saturday night, you know, and you have no other choice. And then other times, some of us will write one for a month or two, right?
Yeah. I think one way that we all, both in finishing the PhD and just like being early career faculty now, is one way we juggle is by a lot of episodes that we put out have something to do with a chapter or an article or a class, a lecture, right? That they were drawing from what we are doing in the other sprints and marathons of our lives. Mm-hmm. And that makes completing the copy a little bit easier for the other stuff, like the editing and the recording day and the, you know, back end blog creation, transcript posting, and the social media stuff. That's just, we just have to do it. It just it just is part of the package at this point. So, but the, at least in terms of putting together an episode, there's a lot of times where we can just, it can be part of what we're doing elsewhere.
So I'm going to be 100% that bitch and say that I think one of the reasons I can do it is because I have a really supportive partner. And I mean, if I had a husband who, like, I don't know, had an ego or like felt like, you know, I don't know, felt like this time wasn't worth it or whatever, or felt like I should be, you know, the woman taking care of the kids and he should be able to fuck off and do whatever. If I had a partner like that, I don't know if I could do it. Obviously,
I don't really see you married to a partner like
that. No, I don't either.
You're like talking about hypothetical.
Yeah, a hypothetical complete asshole. But yeah, just some stupid incel. But no, I'm just saying, I have a partner who I think admires what I do and is impressed by what I do because he couldn't do it, even if he tried. So he is 99% of the time really supportive and doesn't give me shit. Like, tomorrow is his birthday and he's working tomorrow. So today is his only day off around the time of his birthday. And I'm not eating dinner with my family or spending time with them. I'm down here doing whatever. Yeah. And he's okay with it. He's just hanging out upstairs. You know, that kind of thing. Like, he makes it so that, I don't know, I guess I can be kind of a crappy wife and or mom sometimes, or, you know, at least that's how I feel. They give me a lot of grace, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Oh, that's so nice. Flexibility.
I know.
No, I think that's a really important point that, you know, a lot of this is accomplished because we have, you know, people who are willing to let us pursue the things that we want to pursue. And, you know, that said, I have had arguments with my husband before where he's been like, oh, well, you're just going to play with your friends, because we are friends. And so it can very easily look like we're not actually, this is not actually work. This is not actually labor. And I think that that's, it's not just, I mean, I think it's easy to say that about the podcast, but it's easy to say that about lots of academic work, right? That, like, because we're not digging a ditch, it doesn't look like we're working, right?
Yeah. No, right. And so that, and we're doing it from home a lot of times.
Yeah. And so when I'm like, well, I have to go to Averill's house for 6 hours today, I think that that sometimes can be, you know, like, it makes sense to me. I don't buy it, and I don't let him get away with it. But I, you know, it makes sense to me that at some points when, you know, you're frustrated, you might be like, well, you're just going to hang out with your friends all day. And I'm like, you don't understand. This is that's not actually what this is. I mean, it is what it is, because, like, we do take a break and, like, eat soup together. But, like, we're also working. But, I mean, I actually always dread this question. This is a question that I get all the time when I go talk about Dig or lots of other things. But I don't like to answer it because my answer is usually not the right one, which is that I work too much, probably. Sorry if you can hear that. That's my stupid dog barking because it's dinner time and my children are ignoring him. But I probably work too much, and I probably work when I should be hanging out with my kids. I mean, all of my kids right now are in the basement watching TV because I was like, don't even talk to me right now. Go away. Right. So, like, in a way, that's probably not the best thing. Like, I should be, there's
that's
some
what I
scenario
meant about, like,
in which I should be like, I only record after I make multi-course meals for my family and like make, and I'm like, I don't know, maybe.
Or like I set up my children with, you know, homeschooling tasks.
Right.
And I went and nipped out and recorded for a while.
And no, that's not how I function. But that also, like you said, Marissa, like that, that was part of the deal from the beginning with me that, my husband and I both said we wanted to have lots of kids, and I'm holding up my end of the bargain. If you could see me, you would know. But also that, you know, I'm gonna work, and I'm gonna work all the time. And I'm thankful I have a different kind of partner, but my partner is also someone who's very driven and very ambitious, and so we think a lot alike in that way. We understand, you know, when it's a Saturday night and I'm writing copy and he's writing hearing reports, you know, we're just, that's how we are, you know? So,
yeah, I think my situation's different in that my husband is not ambitious, and I don't mean that as a criticism. He would say that about himself.
Right.
He wants to be a stay-at-home dad and never ever have to leave the house at the end. That's like what his
his
life to be. And I know. So, and he knows that. So I told him before we had kids, like, I can't be staying home all the time. Like, I will lose my mind.
Yeah.
I am not a homebody. I need to be out of the house. And, you know, I am ambitious and I'm always working on the next big thing, and that's what it's going to be like. And so even though I think Sarah and James have that in common, my husband and I are complete opposites in that sense, and we kind of complement each other. It sounds very corny, but it works for us, I guess. Yeah. Next question?
Sure. I like this question a lot, and I'm really interested in everybody's responses to it, because I sort of know where people are going to what people are going to say, but I'm interested in hearing you guys articulate it. Okay, when researching, do you guys always interpret sources the same way, or do you sometimes have debates? And so I'm actually going to add sort of a like an addendum to that question, which is like, what sort of perspective do you take when you're putting together an episode? Like, how do you think about framing an episode?
I think
because we each do that differently.
Yeah, we each. So the fact that we are each writing and researching our own episodes, we're not working on episodes together necessarily, means that there isn't necessarily a ton of times when we come up against that potential conversation. But, you know, there have been times when, like, we'll be reading something and I'll say, you know, X, Y, and Z according to this source. And then someone will be like, oh, is that what that means? Or like when Sarah and I had like this passive aggressive sub debate about the usefulness of talking about The Walking Dead as an analogy for,
I was so pissed about that. I still am.
Disease and something. I don't even know what we're talking about. It went on for a really long time. I ended up cutting it out of the episode because it was just ridiculous.
It's a useful analogy.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
I think most of our debates and conversations come about when we are putting the series together, not when we're putting our episodes together. And that always, usually I'm complaining about something or wanting to change something because that's what I do. And Sarah's saying, man, it'll be fine, because that's what Sarah does. And then Avril just says, well, we're doing this, and then I do it. And so I think that would be when we have debates, like, what should the shape of the series be? So if we're doing, you know, another sex series or whatever, a couple of people will say, hey, I'm going to do this because I have to teach it next fall and I want to do double duty and, you know, double dip on this. And then another one of us will say, well, we wanted to do this, but there's too much American stuff going on, so I'll do something totally different, that sort of thing. We try to get coverage, and then we also try to have them cohere is the word I was I talk faster than I think, so we want them to cohere, but we also want there to be some diversity, and, you know, we have a lot of things that we want some to be kind of like deep dives, and then we want others to be more surveys. There's a lot of stuff going on there. So when we decide what we're going to focus on and we pick our episodes, revolving around whatever theme we've chosen. I think that's when most of that discussion and debate comes in.
I think every once in a while we will run into something, and I wish that I could come up with a great example right now, and I can't, but where, especially between Marissa and I, where I'm like, this thing happened in the 19th century and it was important. And Marissa's like, fuck that. It already happened in the 18th century. You know, like, no. People were doing that 100 years before. You're such a 19th century American.
Early modern anything than I ever would have learned had I not done this podcast.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. And medieval.
Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's just one of my things is like, you know, I don't pretend to be a 19th century expert or an expert on, you know, 19th century American history or
I do.
Gilded Age progressive era, like Elizabeth, like I'm not, they know more than me about that stuff 100%. But I guess I just get annoyed. I think when you're in academia, if you're not an Americanist, you are whatever you are. And then everything
that's
else.
The way it should be.
So we have Americanists who teach American history. And then you have, right.
Is there a problem?
And then you have Europeanists who teach European history and world history.
Yeah.
That's just kind of how it's set up in the United States because we're American. So American history is what is of most interest to people. So because of that, Avril and I are always trying to get the two of them to expand their, I don't know.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair. I mean,
horizons, right?
One of the things that we decided to do right from the beginning was to do understudied topics, or at least not understudied topics, but topics that don't show up on history podcasts, right? And as part of that, that means having a global focus. That means that not every series can have something from the mid-19th century, something from the Gilded Age Progressive Era, something from 18th century England, and something from 20th century Ireland. Like, that's not sustainable, and nobody, it would be boring. I mean, although I say that, and there are people out there who, like, sorry, fans, who, like, listen to, you know, 15-hour-long podcasts about one pope, right? So there's an audience for everything. But, I think that we've all learned to push our own sort of specialty boundaries a little bit. And that's only helped me. That's made me a better teacher by far.
Mm-hmm.
So can I ask too, though, in terms of, I mean, that was kind of interpreting, but like what, how do each of us go about kind of conceiving of an episode? Like, how you'll put it together, because each of us, I think, do that differently.
I don't know. I think I tend to go, let me see all the things that might mention this one thing that I'm kind of interested about. And then I try to pull all that together into some sort of cohesive narrative, successfully or unsuccessfully.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like you'll take sort of a question that you have, like, where did the term Le Petit Mort come from?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll go through 15 sources or 20 sources or 25 sources trying to answer that question. You don't know the answer to it when you start, often.
I almost never do the thing where you take a book and then build your narrative out of that the way that I think Elizabeth and Sarah do a lot. I do that.
Right. I do that a lot. Yeah.
We do inductive.
Yes.
I mean, we do deductive.
She says this all the time.
I still like that. Marissa likes to make up words.
No, you know, those are real words.
I find a book and I'm like, I want to center a podcast around this. And then other times I have a whole bunch of, you know, different sources.
Yeah. No, you're definitely a mixed bag. I wouldn't say that you are
more like Sarah,
particularly one or the other. But Avril and I think are pretty similar. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we don't teach American history necessarily, so we have to be generalists. So I think that's where that comes from. That's exactly what I do. I have, like, I mean, for the last episode we just recorded, I printed off, because I had to print them on my own printer and with my own paper and my own toner. I printed off like 18 different articles, and then I had like 3 or 4 ebooks.
Yeah.
And I read probably half of those articles entirely.
But I mean, even when we use one book, we're not only using one.
Whereas,
like, we might frame it with one book and then have like 10 articles in three other books that we're citing.
Right. Right, but you're starting with the idea that you get from the book. Mm-hmm. Right. No, I'm not saying that we do more work. I'm saying that we're starting with all of these very disparate things mm-hmm. and trying to create a narrative that wasn't already there. And then you're starting with a narrative that was already there and trying to deepen it mm-hmm. and explore it in different ways. It's just a different way of writing episodes.
Yeah, I mean, I often have started from one book because for whatever reason, I have the book on my nightstand, or it's like, I really need to, like, for instance, when we did the Ghost Dance episode, I just wanted to know more about that. Like, I didn't actually have a reason for it necessarily. But then once I got into it, I found one book that just like sort of blew my mind, and it ended up really focusing on that, even though I did bring in lots of other things. But then other times, I think the episodes end up, just because of the way I write, end up kind of all looking very similar. But like just the episode that we did, what even did I do? I can't remember. Oh, VD. In the military, that was, like Marissa said, that was many articles mm-hmm. and several different books. But it still is like very tightly focused on one thing. And so it's still kind of guided by a narrative that I already have in my mind a little bit. But it's kind of bringing
Sarah has a very organized
together.
Brain.
I don't know if that's true.
I think you do. You put everything in this kind of unified sort of narrative that just everything just makes sense. And then I think I'm a little bit more like all this crazy shit that doesn't relate to each other. How am I going to make it relate? Like, it's just a different way of thinking.
And I think that this is interesting because this is true of our scholarship, too. Like, all four of us have very different ways that we approach our own writing and our scholarship. And like, I'm very narrative driven. I like stories, and I like having things sort of told in that way. And so my episodes end up being kind of that same sort of story focused, I guess.
I think that also might be discipline focused, because like I tried to do that for the last article that I wrote, and the reviewer outside reviewer was like, no, take this back.
Yeah. No,
analytical section.
Yeah,
it doesn't work.
That's how Europeanists don't want that. Yeah. They don't want some kind of narrative. They want very, very analytical. They want statistics. I think it has to do with the availability of source material. I mean, we're dealing with hundreds of extra years of bureaucratic records and crap going on in Europe than we actually have in the United States. So I think it has to do with the availability of source material, and then just how the cultures of those particular fields have ended up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I do both. I do comparative, so I do both, and both tell me that I suck, you know, for one reason or another. Not that I suck, but both have criticisms that go against each other. And it's like, okay, well, split the baby in half, I guess. I don't know.
Sorry, I'm talking to Ross Perot.
I think now you have to explain that.
Slack.
Yeah.
As one does.
My senior seminar is playing a reacting to the past game centered on the debates around the Vietnam Memorial. And so because we are asynchronous, it's happening on Slack, and my students tend to wake up round about 2.
Right.
So like, just as I'm ready to like, okay, it's time to end the day, they're like, let's have a fierce debate on Slack. It's really cute.
I have my students are doing reacting to the past, just like it's about the Battle of Jumonville Glen, and they have a 6 o'clock deadline. So just now the French delivered terms of surrender to the English, and I'm supposed to say things, and they're all waiting for me, but they'll have to wait. It's fine. It'll be fine.
Yes.
All right. Are we ready for another question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This one's funny. Can you give a future history exam question about today's current political situation that 5 years ago would have sounded like a satirical piece on SNL? For example, which president advised drinking bleach during a global pandemic? Was that Nixon?
Can I tell a really quick story? I had my students do some of those implicit bias tests that Harvard does. I don't know if you've ever heard. It's called Project Implicit. And I had them do these tests to kind of gauge some of their implicit biases in my digital humanities class. And one of the implicit biases was political figures, but the only choices were Trump and Nixon. And so my student was like, my results said that I slightly favor Trump over Nixon. And I was like, those are your only two choices out of all the people, you know, out of all the political figures in U.S. history. They're like, let's compare Trump and Nixon and see who you like more.
I mean, Nixon, obviously. Nixon was actually a great president. What are you talking about?
Well,
he's my favorite president.
Calm down.
I actually have a friend who, hopefully she'll listen to this, but she's one of the most liberal people I know, and she loves Richard Nixon.
Because
he was great on some stuff.
Yeah. Like the EPA.
Sure. Some stuff.
The EPA.
The EPA and also Native American like rights.
Yeah.
CREEP? Come on. That's a really great acronym.
That's like, true. That's true. Good. Anyway.
Admit
it.
Sorry.
Dorking out, but.
You know, this actually raises for me, I will answer the question, but this raises for me the fact that it is really, you can believe this, fucking hard to do a podcast where we focus on the topics that we focus on and try to keep it unpolitical or non-political or apolitical or however you phrase that. And we've gotten blowback for that. Like people, whenever we do have something that intersects, and sometimes we do it on purpose and sometimes we don't. We have a topic that intersects with something that's happening, right? People will be like, you guys are feminist, you know, liberal feminazis.
Social justice warriors.
Yeah. And I think a certain level of that would come either way just because we are women. And we talk about the topics we talk about, which are inherently political. You can't talk about them and have them be unbiased or unpolitical. But it's tricky because sometimes we'll write an episode. Like, for instance, that Rape in Early America episode that I did, I wrote that while I was steaming hot with rage over the Kavanaugh hearings. Like, every paragraph of writing that made me want to cry. But then in delivering it, I had to sort of put that episode together in a way that didn't make it all about Kavanaugh, because that's not a responsible way necessarily to do history. We can draw parallels. We can talk about what we can learn, but we can't be like, isn't this exactly like Brett Kavanaugh? Because it was 200 years ago or something, right? If I was going to write a future history exam question based on things that were happening today, I can't say exactly what it would be, but it would have to do with masculinity and the role that masculinity is playing, like, at this exact moment in the way that this administration is handling this pandemic. I was really struck the other day by Mike Pence's decision not to wear a mask. And I think a lot of that comes from a certain Trumpian brand of manhood, and the performance of manhood particularly. So I look forward to someday reading that dissertation.
So smart.
Somebody's going to write a killer dissertation on this. It won't be me.
I think mine would be also similar, just about gender relations, probably something about incels.
Yeah.
And the ridiculous sort of idea of involuntary celibacy and how it is statistically correlated with violence and also associated with white nationalism and all of that stuff. I think my question, I can't exactly articulate what that question would be, but it would be about that. I mean, and I think that future historians will probably be able to argue that this is a crisis in masculinity that's happening, that is specific to technological age or whatever people are going to call this, like when computers transform society, I don't know. And look at, you know, Reddit things of incels who, you know, were planning to rape women and shit like that. And look back and say, like, what in the world is going on here? And did that work? Right. And also Facebook and Twitter algorithms and bots taking over Facebook, all of that kind of stuff. I just had a something that was removed as hate speech because I said that men don't wash their hands and that they suck. And Facebook was like, absolutely not. That's unacceptable. But I was commenting on an article by a public health official who said that women shouldn't do the shopping during COVID because they take too long. And, you know, so then I responded to that and Facebook was like, absolutely not. Your anti-man stuff is not welcome here, right? Those sorts of ways of policing people's behaviors, I think, will be something that sound absolutely ridiculous in the future when we ask them on test questions.
Elizabeth, Avril?
I mean, my question would probably be not so satirical as real, because I want to know how students 5 years from now think that the COVID pandemic and the subsequent like quarantining and all that will have changed society or not changed society. Like how roaring 20s are we going to be in 2025? Like is this going to be, and like how austerity is some folks are going to go, and decadence are some folks are going to go, and like what the fuck is going to happen
right
in the next 5 years?
Well, and of course, bringing in questions of government and like, you know, are we going to have some kind of governmental revolution like during the depression and the, you know, the New Deal, or right. Are we going to go the opposite and go the way of austerity and.
Right. No, I think those are really good questions. I mean, I think that's also why we're seeing like 5 bajillion op-eds right now being written by every historian that has time, including Leah, trying to think about those questions, right? Like, are we gonna have the danse macabre of 2021, right? Or the Great Gatsby sort of approach to life? Or one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about was I had grandparents who were raised during the Great Depression, and one was a straight up hoarder. And the other just like saved every plastic butter container that he ever encountered because they were useful, right? His garage was just.
Are rewashing Ziploc bags?
Which I do because I
do that too.
Well,
I do.
Okay,
that too,
you're all lunatics, but
they're expensive. But that was an experience that they went through.
Oh my God.
That was an experience they went through as little tiny kids, right? And that got into their bones in some sort of way. And affected the rest of their lives in kind of small, silly ways, but in big, profound ways, too. So I'm really interested I'm interested, and I'm also kind of sad to think about, you know, when my kids are adults in 20 years, like what will their memories of this time period be, and how will it have impacted their lives, the way that they live day to day, right?
Although I think
that's upsetting to me.
Neither of your children will have experienced what your grandparents experienced in terms of scarcity, right?
Because
have jobs right now. Like we have paychecks, but there are many, many families in this country right
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
That can't fill up a cart at the grocery store with like $200 worth of groceries to stock up, right? They're like, they've got the little hand basket and they've got a gallon of milk and a loaf of bread if they were lucky enough to find one, and maybe a couple of cans, right?
And like, $1,200 from the Trump administration to, you know, to shop on, right?
Sure, yeah. My real question, though, is going to be, is 2021 the year for me to start my cult?
Sure. We do want to start a cult, but I'm going to join it, and then we're going to go live on a commune somewhere in rural central New York, some, like, area that is blessed by the spiritualists.
Yeah, some burned over district and then village.
Exactly. And we'll all have different houses that will, you know, we'll be like all on the same lot, but all different houses. So we have
You mean we're not gonna be sister wives?
But then
Well we are, but
well I don't know.
But no,
I
like single guy. We'll just
husbands. We can do just, that. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. No husbands.
Just the wife part.
Just the wife. Oh yeah, then fine. Yeah.
Cut out the middle.
Yeah.
All right. Are you ready for the next one? What has podcasting taught you about your approach to communicating history to the general public?
Podcasting has changed the way that I do history, the way that I tell history stories, the way that I teach, the way that I think about the value of history, right? It's not something that that's stuck in a classroom. It's for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone needs it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Definitely making it more of an everyday and accessible element. And, you know, learning how to tell a narrative better, right? And learning how to be a better storyteller. And I don't have that down, but like, it's a constant thing that I'm working on. And I don't think without having to put it in this type of medium, I would have ever really thought about it as deeply as I think about it now. And so every mm-hmm. time I'm writing an episode, I feel like I'm getting a little closer to that Sarah ideal of being a really good kind of storyteller. But, you know, it has to be engaging, you know, mm-hmm. and it has to be accessible and in some way, like, relate to people's lives in some way or another, you know, so that
mm-hmm.
they care.
Yeah, I think that's a really key point for me, is that we had to learn how to present things. Like, okay, so let me start that answer over again by saying that one of the other things that we from the very beginning said that we wanted to do as a podcast was to translate kind of academic history, like the real work of history, and bring it to the public. We wanted to translate that from, like, you know, things that are being published by university presses, which this is not a criticism of them, right? But to take that information that we think has helped us to grow so much and bring that to people who will otherwise never encounter that stuff, right? I can't tell you how many conversations mm-hmm. I've had with my mom where she's listened to an episode and she said, I had no idea. I've never heard that before. I can't believe that that is something that happened and I never learned it. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's because there's a disconnect
yep.
That people are constantly working very hard to try to address. Right. We always have that, like, op-ed written by some fancy historian who's like, we need to get out of our ivory tower. Like, we already are. Like, there's tons of people already doing that. But that disconnect still exists between, like, the scholarship that we're all doing and the public. And so we had to learn not just how to mm-hmm. talk about history to people, because the History Channel does that ostensibly, right? It's just not doing it well. It's not doing it responsibly. And we wanted to tell all the other stuff, right? We didn't want to do, like, 50 episodes about Abraham Lincoln, even though I could do that.
I mean, that sounds like right up your alley, but okay.
I would 100% do that. I'm launching my own my own podcast yeah. just on Lincoln. No.
You would do a whole episode just on his underwear or whatever.
No, yeah. This is not a lie.
You kidding?
I'm not kidding.
But, you know, we wanted to take all that other stuff, right? So we had to find a way to translate all this other stuff into things that people will actually listen to. And this is why I think Marissa's episodes in particular are so brilliant, because you take things that uh-huh. in American history, American populations anyway, have never heard of, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or something that even to me, I'm like, are you really going to do an episode? Like, what was that episode you did that was about, like, rent or something? I can't
remember. Wait, what?
You did an episode that was about something very... Oh, it was about advertisements in... job advertisement, oh, yeah. want ads,
employment
basically.
Employment agencies, yeah.
And I was like,
yeah, like the beginning
like a
of
very
employment
boring
agencies.
Episode, right? But
no, it was all about like booze.
No, it was. You're right.
Prostitution-y kind of weird stuff.
If
yeah.
you pitched that to the History Channel, they would say there is no audience for that. No one wants to hear about 18th century want ads, right?
Yeah.
And
but they do though. But they, like, I listen to right. other podcasts about true crimes, because I only listen to true crime podcasts, and they'll talk about crimes in the 1800s. You know, I was just listening to one about the Chicago fire in 1871, I think it was. This massive fire. And they're talking about what the context was. Like, oh, well, at the time, fire departments looked like this and building codes looked like this. And they're like, oh, my God, really? People were shocked that that's what it was like. And it's like, yeah, I mean, that's all stuff that I knew from doing my readings and all of that stuff. It's people do care about that stuff. People are interested in that stuff. I think more. I think that we reach a broader audience than people who are interested in, like, let's go down all of the Roman emperors one by mm-hmm. one. There are certain people who love that mm-hmm. for sure. Yeah. But I think that we reach people who didn't think they liked history. I mean, I have several mm-hmm. friends who listen to the podcast religiously who have never listened to any other history podcasts or even liked any history classes. And they just listen to it to, like, make me feel better or whatever. Mm-hmm. And now they love it. So, I don't know. I think it's just a different... I think we're reaching people who are not normally reached.
Yeah, and who don't think of themselves as history people, necessarily,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, right.
And the other thing that I'll say is that by learning how to do that, and I learn it more each time I do an episode, but by learning how to do that, it has made me, I think, a much better teacher. Because I teach particularly a lot of lecture classes. And so I have little choice other than to communicate what I'm trying to teach students through basically what I do in an episode, right? Like talking at people. And so I think I've gotten really good at presenting something that a student might come in the door and be like, why are we talking about this? In a way that ends up being compelling to them.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. and I'm really grateful for that yeah. you know, it's made me a better educator.
And it's made me a better writer. I also like that we don't dumb it down, right? But we have to one of the ways that it makes me a better writer is that I can't assume that anyone has any kind of specialization knowledge about any topic that we talk about. So we have to cover a lot in a little bit of time.
Yeah.
We're like communicating the analysis that really was well respected and up and coming historians are putting out in the world that most regular people who don't have access to an academic library are never going to have access to. And that's what I think is one of the most important things that we do.
So, Avril, you crossed off a couple of these, though, that I think that are really interesting. Can I choose just one of the ones that you crossed off that I swear that it's not duplicating? I'll roll two of them together. Is what is either one historical misconception that you wish people knew about? Or what's one interesting thing that you didn't know about a time period or a topic that you wrote an episode about, that you learned?
You asked for permission and then you did it anyway.
Yeah, so yeah, fun. I did.
It's dinner time. So I definitely learned from doing podcasts, but I really learned being paired up with other people. You know, and like, I'm thinking of the underwear episode that you did, Marissa. Like that was, I loved that episode and I loved doing it. And I learned, you know, so much stuff that I didn't know had I not been on that episode. Or even like the, what was it, like guns, guts, and blood, or it was like the rise of
gun, germs, and steel. Huh?
The rise of medical bureaucracy or something like that.
Oh, the military revolution.
You know, I know what a military Jeffrey revolution Parker. Was. So for me, it's like it's learning from you guys. And then of course, when I dive into, you know, a topic that I may know a little bit about, but when I'm doing an episode, like, you know, I deep dive into it, which is of course nice. But I really like being exposed to, I don't know, some world history that otherwise I just would never venture upon myself or whatever.
Yeah.
I personally think that you are a European / world historian at heart, because I think your style is much more similar to the styles of European historians, more analytical and less narrative than American historians. So I've always thought that it makes you wonder how we choose our fields. I mean, it makes me wonder that, because I think in a lot of ways, like, you seem like a Europeanist to me, or, you know, I don't know, in certain ways. It's
yeah, no.
It's interesting.
I said what? Yeah,
no. Yeah, I am not. Okay. For me, something that I constantly sorry, that I constantly impress upon my students and that I think I say a lot in the podcast is that I think a lot of times our understanding of history, at least at the very, at the popular level, so just what your average Joe knows about history, is very so much colored by Victorian historians who have kind of understood history in a certain way. And, you know, just like Sarah said, you know, oh, like, you know, everybody's kind of in their own little thing. So post-war U.S. historians will say, oh my gosh, like during World War II, it's the first time women were in the workforce.
Right.
It's like, no, women have been in the workforce for fucking ever. It's just the first time they were in the workforce since, you know, for 10 years or whatever.
Since World War I.
It's, yeah, like since World War I. Yeah, I think for me, it's encouraging people to kind of get out of that box a little bit and not Victorianize everything. A lot of just regular folks, I listen to people who don't have anything to do with history, who do true crime podcasts, and they'll say like, oh, well, back in the day, you know, you couldn't do this or you couldn't do that or people couldn't see your ankles or whatever. It's like, you know what? The 18th century was like one of the raunchiest centuries, you know, in time. And my mom even called me and said, oh, my God, like I just watched this because of quarantine. She's just watching Netflix all day. She's like, I just watched this thing about King Louis the 15th. And he just like had sex with people in front of other people. And then the men were having sex with other men. And like the women sex with each other. And I was like, that is literally 18th century France. You're welcome. Like, that is literally what it is. Yeah. Like, that is what court life was like. Yeah. But she didn't know because she thought, okay, well, my parents were all prim and proper and they were, you know, born in 1930. So obviously before that, people were even more prim and proper. And no.
Also because people think that it's that history moves in a linear fashion towards like freedom, right? Mm-hmm. Which is not the case,
not
right?
The case
like it's actually the Jeremy Bear-me. It's all over the place. It goes backwards and forwards and things progress and then they go backwards
again. Pendulum
right?
swings.
Right.
Right. I mean, we're much more conservative now than, you know, as a country than we were in the 1950s.
Yeah, and this is like, you know, Marissa, what I mean? You always say like it's the kids these days argument, right? Like we're continuously coming back to that, right?
It drives me crazy.
Yeah.
The kids these days, it's like, no, people have literally been saying that
just
forever.
Very violent.
I know. Well, I mean, I've read, you know, 17th century treatises of people being like, oh my God, kids these days
are
like co-ed dances. And I'm like, everybody calm down.
It's what the entire Puritan sex episode is about.
Right. Yeah, that's all it is about is that everybody does the kids these days thing.
Right.
I'm not going to fall prey to that.
Okay. You ready for another one?
Last one.
Which one? What are your favorite history podcasts, if you listen to them? Because not all of us do.
Full disclosure, everyone. I don't listen to history podcasts. I just make them. I'm sorry.
I don't listen to them regularly. Mm-hmm. I like American History Tellers. I like Uncivil. Sometimes I like History Chicks, but I'm not a regular listener.
I'm not a super big history podcast listener either. Although I would say that I listen to individual episodes. Like I might not listen to like every single episode as they come out, but I will listen to individual episodes, especially if it's something that I'm really curious about it or that I am trying to work into like a lecture. I'm like, oh, I'm like walking to the library. I need something like to explain. Yeah. I don't know, something about Greek history to me really quickly. But other than that, I really loved Backstory, which I know is kind of coming to its conclusion right now. I learned a lot from Backstory and I use Backstory a lot. Uncivil was fantastic and I've used that on many syllabuses. We should give a shout out to our friends at Footnoting, who do really great work too.
Footnoting is the first history podcast, or actually is the first podcast ever that I listened to. I mean, years ago when podcasts weren't like a thing, and that's the only history podcasts I listened to, and I loved it.
And we have lots of colleague podcasts at Recording History that are all fantastic. And I will, you know, again, I look to them when I need something to fill in an assignment for 1 week in a syllabus. So I don't listen to them all the time, but I definitely, you know, rely on them.
I will say that I assigned a couple of podcast options to my class this year, and I listened to episodes from them before I assigned them. And my favorites were Cocaine and Rhinestones.
Never heard of that. Sounds amazing.
It's country music. Yeah, it's country music.
Wait a minute. How have I never heard of this? This is like literally my life.
Yeah. Yeah. Sarah, you should.
Cocaine and Rhinestones?
Yeah, Cocaine and Rhinestones.
Yeah, okay. I'm downloading that now.
And also Nice Try Utopian, which is all about utopian societies.
I listen to podcasts all day, every day, and it's always true crime for the most part. But I do listen to a few history podcasts, and those are History That Doesn't Suck. I really, really love it. It's really good. It's American history, so I might not have the breadth that I feel like I want, but it's really, really good storytelling, and I really enjoy it. And it is done by a history professor who is trying to make history accessible just like us, and I really admire that. And then History Chicks, I have always loved. That's probably the second podcast I ever listened to in life. They've been around for a very long time, I think since the early 2000s, like maybe 2010. I mean, they've been around for a while. And so that was probably the second podcast I ever listened to. Footnoting, I also loved. They have like a lot of producers, and they had a lot of changeover of producers, and each specialized in different things. So over time, it would be a bit of an ebb and flow as to what I was interested in. There was someone for a while who was doing all like Napoleonic stuff, and I was like, yeah, that's my jam. And then sometimes it would change. So that's all just content related. But History Chicks is, I still listen to every single episode that comes out. They are not historians at all, but I grant them the title of honorary historians. I don't know if I have the power to do that, but they're really, really good. And their sources are incredible, and everything's very, very well researched, and it's biographically based. But I know that Susan and Beckett, who are the hosts, that they read like, I mean, up to a dozen books per episode. It's super intense. So I really love them. And they talk about women, which is cool. Their Annie Oakley episode, one of the best episodes ever.
Awesome.
Okay, last question. What are the dream topics that you would like to cover that you haven't yet covered on Dig?
It's so hard.
It is hard because like we can pretty much do whatever we want. So...
I can't.
Yeah, we shut yours down.
Every time I'm like, I'm going to do this episode about the Civil War, you're all like, ugh.
Poor Sarah.
I don't know. I don't want to say something and then like lock myself in and then be like, oh crap, now I really have to write that episode.
I mean, I just want to talk about like porn and stuff.
It's a tough question.
If I, like, honestly, I would love to do just a porn series. And I mean, if you've seen 18th century porn, it's ridiculous.
It's great.
I mean, I love it, but it's absolutely insane. And it makes you wonder if these people have ever seen people have sex. Because, like, that's not how that works. I've talked to...
Isn't that how all
Yeah,
porn
I mean,
is?
Yeah. No, you're right. But Brian Watson, I've talked to him. I've talked to them about it, about like 18th century porn. It's like, what's going on here? Like they're not using perspective, like nothing is like nothing. And they're like, yeah, that's just, you know, how 18th century porn is. So I would say porn, 100%.
I would say not so much a topic, but in a future where I have more time, I would like to again try an experimental episode with sort of the highly produced with sound effects and stuff and music,
yes,
like we did with
the Victorian household. Yeah, yeah.
That one. Yeah. And then the one
I love it
with progressive Christians with we had
Mark.
Oh,
Mark.
Oh, where we had a guest producer. Yeah.
That one had a lot of
Mark. His name is Mark, right? Am I just making that up?
Yeah.
Mark.
Mark. No, yeah, yeah. Mark Lemke.
Mark Lemke. Yeah. Yeah.
That was a great episode.
Those are cool.
It was
episodes.
Good.
But yeah, like April said, like that's a lot of time.
In a future far
when we can afford to hire an editor and producer to do
hey
stuff
that
us,
will be
right?
me actually because I'm 100% unemployed so
yeah,
I will
we can afford to pay ourselves hello
so once we can afford to pay me we can I would love to that I would love to do contributors more often and follow the layout of like Nursing Cleo. I really admire that the whole kind of like you know regular contributor versus ad hoc contributor sort of thing. That would be great. That would be awesome.
That would be interesting, and it would certainly broaden our horizons a little bit in terms of what kinds of stuff we could present. Like right now we certainly try really hard to do episodes that are global and transnational and things like that. But there's language problems, you know, there's language barriers, like Avril in your Japan eugenics episode, right? Like there's only so much research you can do because you don't speak or read Japanese.
I came across in the episode I just did about Recogimiento. It's like 99% of the scholarship is in Portuguese or Spanish.
Right. And I came across that in my Holocaust
episode.
Yeah, I don't
speak those.
Right. I think if I was... I don't know. I have a hard time answering this because I feel like I get so often to do dream topics, right? Like things that you're like, oh, I just really want to know about that.
Yeah.
I think that gaps that I have, like things that I would like to do more of, I want to do more Native American history and Western history in general. Yeah. Because that's something that we've done a few episodes on, but I would like to have more coverage on that. And I really loved getting to do that episode. As it was one of the most difficult episodes I did, but on disability and the Holocaust. But it sparked a desire to do more sort of World War II and kind of... Yeah. Nazi history, Holocaust history, in general, just partly because I just want to learn more of it. But there are lots of things I still want.
Wish Elizabeth did an episode about the printing presses in the Southwest that you did your article about.
Oh yeah,
like I kind of stuff.
Jovita, right?
The Southwest What's is like name? I mean, like, no, I think the Southwest is an area that is like booming right now in terms of academic.
Well, I shall do more of that.
I mean, I just think it's super interesting. And in a place that's kind of neglected, I think just because of a little bit less population.
It's funny because I feel like I've done like 3 or 4 Borderlands episodes already, so I don't want to like
you have. But I think a lot of them are with history buffs with Dan, right? Weren't they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Maybe so. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, moving forward, I definitely want to do some more, like, I need to push myself further into the 20th century. So I really want to look at some, like, you know, the feminist movement in the 60s and 70s, the Black Panther movement, Black Power. Those are some areas.
We do have sort of a dearth of 20th, later 20th century.
Which is crazy because I love 20th century history.
Yeah, me
like,
too.
I teach it all the time. I mean, that's what I'm teaching 20th century history right now at NU. It's just the new right, like 60s feminism, civil rights movement, Black Panthers, Black Power, all that. It's, we don't have that.
So I'll be teaching that next year. So that's kind of where I'm thinking too. So I'll be kind of leaning that direction, hopefully.
I'm looking forward to it. And I hope I'm on the episodes with you because I love that.
Well, and I was thinking I would do that for this last sex episode, but then April made me do something on Niagara Falls.
That's about the 20th century.
April, it was fun.
I learned things from it. I'm glad. And I was thinking about honeymoon and like post-war honeymoon and, you know, nuclear families and sex and
oh my god, you know, I can't
heterosexuality. Like it's kind of cool. So
I like it a lot. It's a good episode.
I'm really looking forward to it.
coming soon. And that's a great place to wrap this baby.
It is.
Yeah.
So perfect.
Here's our 99th episode coming live to you. And next week, the next episode you listen to will be our 100th episode. We're revisiting our sex series because that was the first series that we launched as Dig.
What's the first step?
What's the first episode up? It's probably going to be, why not? We'll give them the one that's been previewed here, the 1950s and early 19th century honeymoon.
There we go. Niagara the Falls, honeymooners.
A little New York.
New York history. Imagery of the honeymoon.
Canadian. Well, and in doing it, I was like, oh, I'm talking about Canada a lot. We haven't ever done anything Canadian history.
Maybe. I did a French Canadian episode.
Oh, you did. That's
only
right.
One.
Oh,
it's
that's
only. Right. I mean, there's only one.
Yeah.
That we did, but that's
we need to do more Canada. Yeah.
We do. Oh, we need some Canada.
Technically, Northwest.
I was thinking
was
that's the one I was
Canadian.
Thinking of.
Okay,
never mind.
Two.
Give you credit. Whatever.
Very technically speaking,
we're about to have our third with this Niagara Falls episode. So that's thanks for joining us. All those of you who joined us for the live recording, thank you for coming.
Yes,
it's a pleasure to like talk to people's faces in addition to each other. We see too much of each other and not enough of you all. Thank you for supporting us through these 3 years. It's been a wild ride. It's been a joy to bring this history to you, and we will continue to do so long as we can breathe and use these microphones and computers.
So long as we can breathe. Okay, we're committed to this till the end.
We shouldn't take that for granted right now.
Don't actually quote me for that.
Okay, all right. Yeah.
You can follow us if you aren't already on Twitter, Facebook. You can join our Himalaya member community on the Himalaya app, which is a really handy dandy app to get access to all your favorite podcasts like you would on sort of Apple Podcasts or Google Play. But instead of just seeing the episodes, you can actually sort of get special member content like all of our episodes ad-free. You can, if you're an educator, you can check us out on Lyceum, another new podcasting app that curates educational podcast lists. So if you are teaching about the Great Depression, there's probably a curated list in there for you.
If you're an educator, or even if you're a parent who is suddenly crisis homeschooling.
Yeah, for sure. So thanks again for listening. Thanks for sticking around with us these 3 years. And we look forward to many years more and many hundred more episodes.
Yeah. Here's to 100
more. 100
more.
Yay! We love you. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.